So today we'll be talking about QCD actual dark matter. And I hope you still remember this figure, which is how energy densities in the early universe would evolve. There are the orange line, which is the radiation, the red is the matter, and the blue is the cosmological constant. So we already talked a little bit about baryons. We talked about freeze out, right, in the second lecture. And as I just asked Amalia, she said you already worked out the freezing on Friday. So today we'll be talking about one last possibility, which I think is the, very well motivated, and that's the case of QCD axion dark matter, and how these particles gets the right relic abundance to be the dark matter in our universe. So last time we talked about axions, and we arrive at this equation here. I already removed the part, which is the cosine of the pion, because that is set to 1 by the dynamics of the pion. So at low energies, the important piece is here, and which satisfy the condition that theta equal to 0 is the minimum. We also talked about what constitutes a solution of the strong CP problem, which requires both the fact that theta equal to 0 is a minimum, and also I need to turn the theta into a dynamical field such that this field with its early universe dynamics can set it to 0. So I need to make it dynamical here. And today we'll be talking about, given these two conditions, how in the early universe the theta initial, whatever theta initial I pick, will be able to relax to the minimum. Okay, and that is basically the misalignment mechanism. So if I promote the theta to a field like this, the first thing before we study cosmology would be trying to find out the potential of this new degree of freedom A, right, the axion. So this is the axion. And what I do is basically I take the second derivative of the energy density or the potential and expand it around theta or theta equal to 0 or A equal to 0. Then this is what I'm getting. So I get ma squared. Okay, so around the minimum is equal to okay. Okay, so basically what I did is I take the second derivative of this potential and expand it around equal to 0. This quantity is dimensionless. The dimension 4, FA is dimension 1, so this has dimension of mass squared. Okay, so what you see from the this equation is that apart from this coefficient, which in the standard model is roughly like 0.2, the mass of the axion times the axion decay constant is always a constant, which is equal to mass of the pion times the pion decay constant. So both of these quantities are order 100 MeV, and it sets a relation between the mass of the axion and the axion decay constant FA. So I can make a plot now of the parameter space, where I have MA on the x-axis, and here I have 1 over FA on the y-axis. So going up is smaller FA or bigger 1 over FA, okay? While going this way is a bigger mass. So here we'll be talking using, let's say, mass in EV, and here I have this quantity in GeV inverse. Then we can plot a line in this plot, right? Because MA times FA is is a constant, I can plot a line like this if I'm doing a log-log plot. Okay. So here we'll be talking about somewhere between nano EV all the way to EV with something like micro EV here, milli EV here. And this point corresponds to roughly like 10 minus 10 GeV, 8 GeV inverse. And there's some other value. But like the important thing is that if I'm talking about a heavier axial masses, it couples stronger because F8 is smaller. And if I'm talking about lighter axion, it will be coupling weaker because the F8 is bigger. Okay, so this is the usually what people call QCD axion line in the plot of FA and MA. Okay, so in the remaining of the lecture, we'll be talking about which type of axion masses can be the dark matter in our universe. And what we are going to do is we are going to put another line in this plot with which we'll be able to get a point, which is the point where like it is most likely to have axion dark matter. So we're going to do that. OK, so that's the goal of today. Are we clear with that? OK. Cool. So what are we trying to understand today is if I start with some initial set angle, which is randomly picked, let's say something that is order 1, how does it get to close to theta equal to 0 today, right? So to do that, we need to first have this minimum. And secondly, not only do we need like a theta to be dynamical, we also need some additional condition, that is this theta angle, which contains some energy, would be damped over time. Okay, so let's draw an analogy with the molecule thing that we talked about last time, right? So remember last time we talked about CO2, and we can start a CO2 with some initial angle theta I, and as a function of time, the thing will oscillate and release energy. Due to either collisions with other molecules or just electromagnetic radiation. All of these effects are captured by some energy loss rate. And we usually describe this thing as an oscillator, which has the equilateral motion like this. Okay, so theta min is the minimum. This is equal to 0. And it is characterized by two parameters, right? For any oscillator, the frequency of this oscillator and the friction it experiences. So depending on the relative size of these two parameters, we can have a couple different conditions. First, if I have this friction much, much bigger than omega naught, then I have an overdamped oscillator. Right, so this is like I'm holding this molecule in place with a lot of friction forces. In that case, this angle won't relax because I'm holding it in place. Right, like I'm just making sure, like using some additional external force to keep it in place. In this case, this is I think like an overdamped oscillator, which may and the important thing is say that T is a constant. In this case, in the other case, if gamma is much, much smaller than omega naught, right, then mostly it is just oscillating while the friction is taking energy away as the thing is slowly going around, right? So in this case, I have an underdamped oscillator. And the theta of t can be solved to be something like e to the minus gamma t cosine omega naught t. Okay, so these are the two cases of an oscillator. Depending on whether gamma is big or like omega naught is big, you can have these two conditions. Of course, like in the case where like these two are comparable, like it is more complicated, and we are not going to talk about that very much here. Okay, So since we are going to draw analogy between the case of the axion and the case of the molecule opening angle, then we need to find out, in the case of the axion, what parameter is playing the role of gamma and omega naught, and what do we mean by theta here, right? So the first question, what is theta here, is easy. It's basically the theta that we have used before. And in principle, I'm going to replace this thing with A over FA, the axion field. OK? So once I do that, this comes from the second derivative of theta for a molecule. And here, this omega naught squared is going to be replaced by here the mass of the axion squared. So the ma squared is playing the role of the fundamental frequency of this oscillator. OK, so now, so the question now becomes this last parameter. So what is playing the role of the friction, right, in the case of the axion? And it has to be energy scale or time scale. So as we have learned many times before, whenever I need a time scale in an oscillator equation, that thing is the whole Hubble scale. So this most likely is going to be Hubble. So how do I see that? Okay, question? No. OK, sorry. So how do I see that? Well, what I need to do is to actually solve this thing exactly. So let me instead of looking at an axion with a very weird potential, just look at a particle which has a potential term that is m squared phi squared. So let's say I have a scalar field with the following action. Some kinetic term and some potential term like m squared phi squared. So when I write down the thing in an expanding universe, we can find the equation motion of the scalar field as phi double dot plus 3h phi dot plus m squared phi squared equal to 0. Okay. So here, the Hubble comes from the fact that these terms contain the metric. And you can not only hit the derivative on the field, which will give you something like phi dot square, phi double dot, you can also hit this derivative on the metric, which will bring you something like a dot. And if you gather them all together, it becomes some Hubble, which comes in front of the phi dot. Okay, so the details you can work out after the class when you. Or if you go to Sergey's class, he'll tell you how to compute these field equations in curved spacetime. But the important thing here is that you see how Hubble would appear in an equation motion of a massive scalar field with the mass m. Okay. And here, the Hubble, we use the Hubble scale in radiation domination that will be 1 over 2t. And the important thing is not like how the scaling actually look like, but just the fact that as a function of time, this Hubble scale becomes smaller and smaller. It is so unlike in the case of the molecule, this gamma or this friction factor is not a constant, but a function of time. Okay. So now what do we have? So like in this case, we are going to write down the different conditions, right? So in the case where Hubble is much bigger than m or ma, OK, mass of the axion here, what you have is an overdamped oscillator. So let me write this as a, sorry. OK, so if Hubble is much bigger than ma, then what I have is an overdamped oscillator. So a of t is a constant, right? And in the case where Hubble is much, much smaller than ma, Then I have a like underdamped oscillator, so I can and do some sort of like a WKB approximation, which gives me something some factor which B of t, let's say, like which characterize how does the thing gets damped over time, multiplied by this cosine MAT, which is the fact that this field is oscillating. So we are going to need to find out what this is in a moment. These are the two qualitative behaviors which are important depending on whether Hubble is big or Hubble is small. Okay. So let's first work with the case where this mass is a constant. Okay. And h is something that is a function of time. Right. So what do we have? As a function of time, if I plot Hubble and the mass, mass is a constant. Well, at the same time, Hubble is something which goes down as a function of time. So again, this is a log-log plot. So what you see is that in the earliest of times, like a very early universe, this A field, or the scalar field, is just staying wherever it is, starting position, right? So this here, during this period, what I will have is A is just equal to A initial. It's not oscillating. It's not moving at all, pretty much. On the other hand, in the late universe, when the Hubble scale has decreased to be small enough to the point where MA becomes bigger, then this scalar field is going to start oscillating and start slowly damping down. So, in terms of energy density, what it tells you is that initially, since A is a constant, the energy density which goes as m squared a squared is also going to be a constant. Okay. So, this is the behavior which looks like cosmological constant. Well, at a later time, it is going to be slowly damping down, and we are going to figure out what that is. So, as if I put this thing in total in a plot, what I have is that A of t is a constant initially, right? A is equal to A initial, and then as a function of time, it is going to oscillate and it goes to damp. So the question now becomes, figuring out B of t, which is what is this envelope here. OK? So we're going to do that. Any questions? All right, so let's see how I do this. For anything which is slowly damping down and oscillating somewhat fast, we can use what is known as the WKB approximation and write down this field, A of t, as basically, e to the minus integral of gamma t dt times this cosine mat. And I take this, and I plug in back in here. Right? That's what I usually do. So the first term has a double dot, so one of the derivative if both of the derivative hits here, then it is basically canceling this m squared a squared. Okay, so that term is gone. The second term, in terms of size, is one of the derivative hitting here and the other one derivative hitting here, right? And I have two of them. I get a minus sign. So what I get is minus 2 gamma t sine mat. OK, with amplitude, let's say. So multiply by amplitude. And here, like I get also something at the second order, right? So I get plus 3 ht sine mat, again, times amplitude equal to 0, right? So this means that gamma t is equal to 3 halves ht. And H I know is A dot over A. So this is what I'm getting. Okay? So now I plug in back in here. So I want to know what is gamma t dt. And that is just going to be 3 halves dA over A, or 3 halves d log A. And as a result, if I just plug it back in here, then I will find the axiom field as a function of time. OK, so this is the axiom field. And this is the scale factor. Now I remember why I used phi, but OK. What you'll find is that instead of decaying exponentially, right, like in the case of the molecule, here it is decaying with a power law because the thing that enters in the exponent is a logarithmic function. And what you are going to get is A at t at a time where Hubble is equal to mass of the axiom over A at any time later to the 3 halves power times cosine mat. Okay, so here, this A here is the axiom field, while these A's are the scale factor. So, here, like because the Hubble scale, the friction gets slower and slower as a function of time, this damping is not exponential damping anymore. It is a power law damping, and it has a scaling like this. Okay? So why do I want to get an equation like this? Well, if I square it and compute, like here, what is rho as a function of time, then what I'm getting is basically m squared times the axiom field amplitude squared, which goes as basically A over AT cube. Okay? And this is something that you have seen before. Okay, so the scale factor goes as 1 over the temperature. So if you have a scale factor ratio to the cubed, it means that this density is redshifting as t cubed. And what and the, something that scales redshifting like a t cubed is basically matter. Okay, so this is the redshifting of matter. Okay. So here, what I showed you with all of these mass is the fact that this envelope of decay is the same as redshifting of matter densities. And I know dark matter redshifts like the deciding factor of dark matter is that it redshifts like matter. So this is how you see if I have a scalar field which starts oscillating after the time when the Hubble scale is equal to the mass, it will redshift like matter afterwards. Okay? So that's the important information that is contained in all of these derivations. Okay? So once we figure out this qualitative fact, now we can just put in some numbers and compute the relative density. So like in the case of Friedzout, first I'm using some information about the very early time, right? Like this exponential decay, which stop. And then like I'm tracking it all the way down to t equality to figure out what is the mass of the particle that we are interested in. Here, again, we are going to do that step where we take the initial density, which is the density here, and see after some redshifting what would be the parameters that I need such that at some later time it will be equal to the dark matter density at the time of matter radiation equality. So that's what I'm going to do next. So first, rho initial. What is rho initial? It's basically the thing that I'm computed here, which is equal to some ma squared fa squared times some theta initial squared. And this number, if I'm randomly sampling some like a initial condition in the early universe, this thing has an expectation that it's order 1. So let me just take it to be 1 to start with. Okay, so this is the initial energy density of the axion. At the time when the Hubble scale in the universe is equal to the mass of the axion. Okay? So at the same time, I can compute what's the radiation energy density, right? Which goes as a t cube, a t to the 4, of the temperature of the standard model at that time. And I know that in radiation domination, Hubble is equal to T standard model squared during M Planck. So if I plug in here, then what I will find, so these two combined is going to tell me that T standard model is going to be equal to MA M Planck to the 1/2 power. Right? I'm using this equation and I'm using this equation, and this is what I'm getting. And as a result, I find rho gamma is going to be ma squared m Planck squared, or n gamma, which is ma m Planck to the 3/2 power. So this is the number density of the photon at the time when the axion start oscillating, right? So afterwards, the axion is oscillating in red shift like matter, this red shift like radiation. But this quantity of number density of axion over the number density of a gamma is a constant, right, as a function of time. So we can find rho a over rho gamma is equal to ma over, so at the t equality, is equal to Na over N gamma at the t equality, okay, which is also equal to Na over N gamma at the time h equal to Ma, right? And I can plug in here the things that I found before. So this is the number density of the axion is the energy density over ma. So I remove 1 ma from here. So this is the number density of the axion. At the same time, the number density of photon is this quantity here. So I take this and I plug in here. And what I'm getting is ma to the 1/2 power fa squared over m Planck to the 3/2 power times the temperature at matter radiation equality. Okay, so now this, of course, at the matter radiation equality, if it is all of dark matter, should be equal to 1. Right? So with all of these mass, what I'm arriving at is a relationship between another relationship between the mass of the axion and FA. Okay, and these two parameters I know from observations, right? So this is one is 0.1 eV, this one is M Planck, which is like 10 to the 19 GeV. So I get a second relation between MA and FA, which are not the same as the one that I had before, coming from the equation here, which is a mass FA relation. So what do I have is a second line, which I can put in this plot, right? And in that case, I have ma 1/2 fa squared going as m Planck, 3/2 t equality, right? So it is a line which is flatter, right, than this one. So it goes something like this. And the reason I draw it like this is because I know from experience, like when do they cross, and the location across will be at the point that I will have dark matter in the universe coming from this misalignment mechanism, right? So what do? So we studied the early universe cosmology of a scalar field. I understand like a rash of like matter. I use the fact that at the time of matter radiation quality has to be equal to the energy density in the universe. And then with all of that, I managed to get a second relation between MA and FA, such that like the energy density is exactly equal to the dark matter, the amount that I need for dark matter. And that points to me to a point in the axion parameter space, which would allow me to get 100% dark matter. Okay. So this point, as we know, is somewhere between micro EV and milli EV. Okay. And it is the point where like there are a lot of experiments. Okay. So this is cool, but this is not totally correct. And you are going to do the correct thing in your tutorial. So let me tell you why this thing is not totally correct. And how you are going to make it more correct in your homework or tutorial. So the thing that I omitted in all of this computation is the fact that the axial mass is actually not a constant as a as a function of time. Okay. So MA of axion is not a constant for QCD axion. All right, so anyone know why? When does the axial mass come up, become non-zero? So when does a pion become, like become a pion? When does a pion get a mass? OK. So a pion gets a mass during the QCD phase transition, right? So after the QCD confines, we can talk about mesons and baryons, and we can talk about these particles and these particles getting a mass. Before that time, right? Before the time of the QCD, so before t, equal to something like lambda QCD. The QCD is deconfined, and there are not something degree of freedoms that we call pions or kaons and all of these mesons or baryons, like protons. So here, though the axion is not really a particle that is like the pions, it also its potential also disappears before the time of confinement. So in the early universe, this MA is actually equal to zero. If QCD doesn't confine, there is no axial mass. So instead of being a constant, as we assumed earlier, right? So this is what we assumed earlier for MA in this plot here, for example. This is not true. It actually goes something like this as a function of time. So this is M as a function of t. Where this time, when the mass turns on, is roughly the time when the temperature of the universe is equal to lambda QCD. Okay. So now, if I draw this Hubble scale as a function of time as well, so this is Hubble of t, right? Instead of earlier, we find that the crossing, right, where Hubble equal to MA is going to happen at some earlier time. If the mass is only turning on at some later time, this would be actually the point where the H equals MA condition is met. So because of this, the axion actually started oscillating later than what we expected. So this means And if it oscillates later, it has less time to redshift, so it has more energy density later on. Okay, so you are going to work out this particular case, I think in either a tutorial or homework, and which will give you a condition that is slightly different from the one that we found there. And the condition you are going to find is MAFA squared is going to be equal to the temperature of the QCD phase transition, which is roughly a GeV, times the equality times M Planck. Okay, so this is something that you're going to work out. Okay, but qualitatively, it is not very different because all I'm getting from all of these this computation is a second relation between the mass of the axion and FA, right? Which will allow me to put a line in this plot and find out what is this mass where the two lines cross. If you do this everything correctly with this misalignment mechanism, you are going to get that this crossing point is when MA is equal roughly 10 microelectron volt, and FA is 10 to the 11 GeV. Okay, so that's going to be the misalignment. Okay, and that's the reason why like we have built a lot of experiments in this particular region to look for QC axion. So if you look at this number and convert it into a length scale, this is roughly like a 0.1 meter to 1 meter. Okay, so lambda A, which is 1 over MA, is roughly like a meter scale. And we are going to be talking about, in the last lecture, how we are going to look for this this particle with some experiment called ADMX. Okay. So this is the misalignment mechanism. So if I put this thing on this plot that I draw before, what you see is that initially, the energy density is a constant, right? Before it starts oscillating, it behaves roughly like the cosmodule constant. And at a later time, it evolves like matter. And that's basically the last line I want to put in this plot, which is the misalignment mechanism, okay, where the energy density is a constant and then redshifts like matter. Okay. Any questions about this? Okay. So when I say this is the last line, I lied because I'm going to tell you something different. Okay. So lastly, I want to be telling you about a second type of production mechanism for the QCD axion, which are through cosmic strings and domain walls. Okay. So we might not finish this thing today, but if we don't, we'll continue next time. So anyone have heard about cosmic strings, domain walls? Yes? No? No, somewhat. Okay, so these are topological defects which can have appear like in the early universe, and to see how these things would play a role, let me actually ask the question of what happens if I just continue to go to the early universe to the very very early times. Okay, I can go back always back in time, and the temperature will keep growing until at some point it's just bigger than everything else. Okay, so in that case, something that we used throughout this talk, this lecture, which is this parameter here, FA, will no longer be a constant. Okay, so let's see how this works. So remember, last time, we say we are going to promote this angle to a field written this way, A over FA, right? So if I think about where this would come about, the thing that will give you something like A over FA is actually something like a Higgs mechanism. So if I have some complex scalar field in the early universe, which have a potential, okay, so this is more like a phi conjugate square, then in the early universe, or like at zero temperature, let's say t equal to zero, the phi would want to be in the minimum, right? So this is just like the Higgs that you study in the standard model class. You will want the phi wants to have an expectation value which is equal to FA, because it wants to be in the minimum of this maximum head potential. So and like if I expand around this minimum, okay, I will find that phi is equal to some FA plus rho times e to the I A over FA. So I have a complex scalar field in the minimum. It gets a vacuum expectation value like the Higgs. So this is just like the valve of the Higgs, plus a radial mode, which is just like the Higgs. So this is going to be the Higgs like the Higgs excitation, right? The one that is 125 GeV. And it will have like this additional factor, so this phase, which is like the axion field, it's a goldstone which is going around this maximum head potential. So in the standard model, this goldstone is eaten by the W boson and Z boson and makes them massive. Okay, that's the Higgs mechanism. In this case, if we are talking about a field which has this U1 global symmetry, then this is going to be a true goldstone, which may get a potential at low energies. Okay. So this would be how A over FA come about from a UV complete theory, which will allow us to track what happens above the temperature of T equal smaller than FA to the time where T is bigger than FA. Okay. So then, so this is what happens at zero temperature, and this will give me the axion couplings to all the standard model fields that we wanted from last lecture. But this will also allow us to ask the question, what happens when the temperature actually becomes bigger than FA, right? So when the temperature is bigger than FA, then what happens is that I should not use this potential anymore because there are thermal corrections. Most importantly, the leading thermal correction to this potential goes as lambda times temperature square times phi square. Okay, so doing this computation is complicated, but like you can think of it as the same computation maybe Mina did when she was explaining the hierarchy problem. So it goes as the coupling times some high scale, like the UV cutoff, like lambda square times phi square. In a thermal system, you replace this lambda square with t square, and you get a thermal potential because of the interaction of this phi with the thermal bath. Okay? Well, and the thermal bath here is basically the phi field itself. So if you have, and the important thing is that this term is always positive. And if you look at this delta V and this V here and expand it out, what you'll realize is now the scalar potential look like this. So it has minus lambda FA squared, maybe with a 2, right? So times phi squared. I get a lambda t squared times phi squared And then like I get a lambda phi to the 4 term. And of course, I have some terms which doesn't depend on phi. Okay. So what you see is that at high temperature, when temperature is much bigger than FA, this term, this combination is a positive number. And as a result, the symmetry is restored, right? Phi equal to 0 is the minimum instead of phi equals to FA. So what do we see? So at t much bigger than FA, the potential V of phi as a function of phi actually look like this, right? So you still have like the circle going around. Well, at t much, much smaller than FA or t equal to 0, the potential look like this, OK? So where this is the minimum. So at low energies, so at low temperature. So what you have is that from the very early temperature where the symmetry is restored, you need to go through some phase transition to this new point where this potential looks like the Mexican hat. Okay, so basically what happens is you are going to go from this point to a random point in the circle, right, as the universe cools down. So, and you know that in the early universe, the Hubble scale is very large. So the Hubble horizon is very small. And all of these Hubble horizons are causally disconnected. So you'll have a different patch of the universe where this phase transition is happening on its own, independent of each other, not knowing like what each other is doing at a different Hubble patch. So let's see, draw a bunch of Hubble patches, and let's see what happens. Okay, so let me say this one decides I want to be at theta equal to 0. I want to be here. This thing decides I want to be at pi over 2. So I want to be somewhere in this direction, right? Theta equal to pi, and theta equal to 3 pi over 2. Okay. So the different Hubble patches will choose a different location in the circle to get it to. And what you now see is that I get some randomly distributed. So this case is not random, but like imagine it is something random. And it's a small region out of this randomly selected vacuum. What you will see is that these all different regions will have different theta. And when all of these universes expand, right? Each one it will expand until they meet each other. They will realize that around this point here, so this very spacing point here, the theta angle wants to go from 0 to 2 pi. Okay? And that is something that is topological, meaning that no matter if I make the theta equal to 0 region bigger or the region where theta equal to pi bigger, around this point, I always go from 0 to 2 pi in a circle. Okay. So that's the region where a topological defect has formed. And this mechanism for this formation is called the Kibble mechanism. Okay, so it doesn't require very much. All you need is there is a UV Lagrangian, and the universe heats up to the point where the symmetry is restored in the ultraviolet at a very high temperature in the very early universe. As the universe cools down, the different small Hubble patches, which are causally disconnected, choose their random values independent of each other. And if you do that, then there are going to be regions where the angle goes from 0 to 2 pi. And as a result, there are these topological defects that are forming. And the thing that is formed in this point is basically a cosmic string, and in particular, an axion string. OK? So here I basically told you how this string can form. Now let's see what do they do afterwards. Make this up. Okay. Any question?
If we account for inflation, then we won't have causally disconnected regions.
Sorry, I cannot hear you.
If we account for inflation, then we won't have causally disconnected regions in very early universe.
You mean if there's no cosmic inflation, or
there is cosmic inflation?
Well, like if you have cosmic inflation, actually, like the universe gets expanded, right? And each small patches. Initially, of course, there are correlations which are generated such between them, but the later evolution, right, when the universe has reheated and it has go to some high temperature, and during this phase transition, at that time, the different universes, they are causally disconnected, right? Though they have been causally connected in the very beginning, at this time, when the symmetry is getting broken, they are causally disconnected, so they are going to choose their values independently. Okay. So this is a case where some random fluctuation was generated after inflation, and that's where all these topological defects form. Okay. All right. So we talked about the axion strings and how they would form. Now let's see how they look like. Okay, so a cosmic string is a string which is characterized by its string tension mu, which is equal to FA squared. Let me do a tittle sign because there are pi's and logs, which are not very important for now. So the string is characterized by the fact that the axion field going around the string goes from 0 to 2 pi. So around the string A goes from 0 to 2 pi FA. Okay? And as a result, it's a topological defect which cannot be shrinked. Okay? So there are a few important things. So first, if I have an individual string, unlike radiation and matter, so matter is like a one-dimensional point, so it redshifts as 1 over a cubed. This string is something like a zero-dimensional point, so it redshifts like a cubed. Here, the string is a one-dimensional object, and as a result, it will redshift like 1 over a squared. If I just have an individual string. And as a result, it's redshifted like even slower than matter, meaning that they don't interact with each other, even if I start with very limited number of strings, they will quickly dominate the energy density of the universe because they are really, really flat, like in this plot. Okay. So that's the one thing. And in particular, if I say, ask like what's the ratio of the density of string over the density of photon for isolated string, this will go as a squared, which means that this thing will increase as a function of time. The second thing is, of course, these strings interact, and the first thing that it does, it radiates. So the string are like wires, so they are oscillating, and while they are oscillating, they are radiating things out, and the amount of radiation that comes out of the axion string is proportional to its tension, or like it goes FA squared. Okay, so and these radiation are basically axion radiations. So the thing is oscillating and oscillating off some axions, which gets oscillated out with a rate that is FA squared. So this is independent of the length of the string. It's just a constant, which is the tension. Okay, what this means is that if I ask the lifetime of the string, it will be the energy that is contained over, in the string over this radiation power, right? So the energy contained in a string is mu, the string tension times the length, right? The power is mu. So the lifetime is equal to L. Okay. So what does it mean? This means like if I have an axion string loop, which is smaller than the size of the Hubble, over a Hubble time, it has disappeared. Okay. Okay. All right. So number three is that the axion strings actually interact with each other. So and the interaction basically goes like this. So if I have a string like this, and let me put another string like that. Okay. So the orange is one string, and the white is another one. Then it can have interactions such that they exchange partner with each other. So the white and orange now looks like this. Okay. So they cut each other and pick something else, pick another one to go together with. All right. So this is how axion strings can interact with each other. And what this allows you to do is, for example, if you have a situation like this, and if this cut, then form a small loop plus a longer one. Okay? And if we use number two, then the thing is going to disappear after the loop is formed. Okay? So, and this cross section of this interaction is basically a parameter, which is order one, which parameterizes how likely it is for the string to exchange partner with each other, right? So it's a dimensionless number, which is order one, multiplied by the length of the string square, or L1 times L2, the length of the two strings. Right? So they are just geometrical, like knowing like whether these two strings will cross each other. Okay. So if I take this cross section and I do what we always do, we compute gamma, right, with over Hubble. Then what I'm doing is basically the number density of string times L squared, right? Let's say like the strings have a similar length. Hubble is a scale which, as we know here, is comparable to the string length for the length of the string that we care about. So this is 1 over L, and L is order 1 over Hubble. So this tells me that if the number of string, a density of the string is 1 over L cubed, we have gamma over Hubble equal to 1. Okay? If the number density of the string is bigger than 1 over L cubed, or Hubble cubed, then they are going to interact faster than the Hubble expansion. Well, if the number of string is smaller than h cubed, then they are going to interact slower than Hubble expansion. Okay? So now we can put this thing together and find something that is called the scaling solution, which basically tells you that in a string network, the number density of string, which is always going to be order Hubble cubed. Okay, and the way that you see it is the following. So if you have more than one string per Hubble cube, Then they are going to interact with each other regularly, like to efficiency. They are going to produce these axion string loops, which disappear due to mechanism two. On the other hand, if you have string number density that is smaller than one per Hubble cube, smaller than Hubble cube, then this rate over Hubble is smaller than one, so they don't interact. So the string which are not interacting is going to grow in energy density compared to the radiation, which otherwise means that the number density of the string will increase. So these two are processes make sure that if I'm talking about a cosmic string network, or especially the cosmic axion string network, I will always get to this scaling solution where there are order one string per Hubble patch at any time. Okay. So lastly, let me just write down the energy density of the string, which now is equal to mu squared times L, right, which is the mass of each individual string, times the number density of the string, which is HQ. And L and H are roughly the same. So this is mu squared times H squared. Or if I ask, what is rho string over rho gamma for interacting string network, this is always mu squared Hubble squared over Hubble squared and Planck squared, right? So this is the energy density in the radiation sector. So this is always going to be equal to, mu. Mu is dimension 2, g mu. Okay, so this is the thing that we get to the end. What we learn is that if I have a string network, it will always have energy density, which is proportional to g, the gravitational constant, times mu. And of course, mu is Fa is smaller than Planck. So this is something that is always smaller than 1. But importantly, this ratio between the energy density that is stored in the string over the energy density that is stored in the photon is always going to be a constant, right? And the energy density of the string tracks the energy density of the photon. So if I go back to this plot here, what it means is that for a string network, it will always have energy density which is parallel to the redshifting of the photon, of the radiation, right? But it is much smaller, and the amount that it is smaller is g mu. Okay. So next time, we are going to go from this point here, and again connect it to matter, and see from the string network what type of parameters do we need such that it will be the dark matter in the universe today. So that's all I want to say today. Questions?
Why is the Hubble rate roughly of the order of the length of the string?
So like the Hubble is both a time scale and also a length scale. So the size of the universe with some Hubble expansion rate is roughly 1 over the Hubble. So that's the size of the universe, right? So so here, the reason why I always choose L equal to that is comparable to 1 over Hubble is because the ones that are much less than Hubble is going to disappear very quickly, so we don't really care about them very much. And the ones which has a length that is longer than Hubble basically goes through many Hubble patches. And I'm only interested in the part which is in my Hubble patch. And as a result, it can also not be much bigger than Hubble, 1 over Hubble. That's why we are going to be focusing on the string lenses that are comparable to Hubble. So this is the case for axion strings. For generic cosmic strings, this is not quite the case. But if you're interested, we can talk about it more.